And then the second thing that differentiates banks from corporations is that a corporation doesn't care where the funding comes from. If they need $1 billion to develop Iranian energy sector, they don't care whether that $1 billion comes from a Chinese bank or from a Russian bank or from an Iranian bank or from a JP Morgan. But JP Morgan does care,
Yeah.
because if the loan comes from JP Morgan, then that's a $1 billion asset on JP Morgan's balance sheet. If it comes from a Russian bank, that's a $1 billion asset on the Russian bank's balance sheet. So, for the banks, it's an all or nothing situation. For the corporation, we can do it this way, we can do it that way. So they're not the ultimate source of the incentives for forever wars.
Good day, everybody. It's me, just Steve Yang here with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I'm thrilled to have Alex Craner, a trader, market analyst, writer, one of the most respected voices in the commodity space. He'd tell you he's just an ordinary guy, but for many, he's a go-to for trying to understand what's happening in this world. So, Alex, great to meet you in Atlanta, but it's an honor to have you and to learn from you here. So thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm doing really well, Steve. Thank you for having me, and my warm greetings to all your viewers and listeners.
Well, thank you. Alex, lots going on. I want to start off by the Trump's visit in Beijing. What do you make of it? How do you see a substantial shift happening in US-China relations? Does anything stand out, and what do you think the visit actually achieved?
I think we'll need a bit more time to understand what the visit really achieved. I think it's, diplomacy is always good, building rapport is always good, mutual understanding is always good. But it would be one thing if I thought that Donald Trump was fully in control of his administration. I'm not sure that that's the case, and I think that, it was quite significant that that Xi Jinping asked him if we could, avoid the Thucydides trap. What Xi Jinping meant by this is that in the long cycle of history, most of the time, the outgoing dominant power in the world, the outgoing hegemon, always went to war against up-and-coming dominant powers. And I think that it's called Thucydides' trap because, in Thucydides' times, Sparta was the hegemon and Athens was the up-and-coming power, and then Sparta went to war against Athens to try to keep it down. So that's And he asked him this question, and of course, Trump doesn't really have an answer because Trump is temporarily the head of the American administration. He has less than 3 years left, and even so, it's not certain that he gets to decide matters of war and peace. We'll have to see, but Trump almost seamlessly transitioned from talking about international cooperation and peace with Xi Jinping to threatening more war against Iran. And I think the Iranian episode is where my optimism about the Trump administration was largely shaken up.
Tell me about, if you can tell me a little bit more about Donald Trump not having full control over his administration, as well as what you mean by the Iran war and what in particular stands out to you.
So on 28 February, Trump invaded, well, Trump attacked Iran in the middle of negotiations, right? And I was among the people who, up until just a few days before that, was fully convinced that there wouldn't be any such war because it just didn't make any sense. I thought the downside risk was enormous, likely catastrophic. The upside to the war, I couldn't figure out what it was at all. The probability of it succeeding was really a long shot. And Trump himself has been consistent for years talking about how dumb it would be to attack Iran, and that that his previous presidents were basically many things. Previous presidents were basically doing this, that Trump was saying that they were doing this to distract from their other problems. That, and so anyway, it didn't seem like he had any enthusiasm for it. And so that wasn't just my impression. That was the impression of many people who were close to him, who were many were very surprised that Trump went to war against Iran. And one of them was Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson said that he's been talking about this with Trump for pretty much 10 years, and that he believed that they were completely on the same page and that Trump was perfectly aware of the risks. And so Tucker Carlson himself was very surprised when Trump attacked. And so to me, that suggests that somebody somehow managed to push Trump over the edge and to push him into attacking Iran. So this, to my mind, is relevant because today, he's wrapping up his visit to China. He might make all the right sounds and noises. He might genuinely feel warm about having a good relationship with Xi Jinping. But when push comes to shove, maybe other interests will prevail, and he'll be told, no, you have to defend Taiwan. And we're gonna go to war. Whether we win or not doesn't matter, because a lot of these wars are not fought because anybody believes that they could be won. They're being fought in order to be fought, because the military industrial complex makes a lot of money. The banks take control of the target nation's collateral, and on and on and on. So there's a lot of vested interest arrayed in favor of war, and the commander in chief ultimately might succumb to those interests, as we have seen with Trump with regards to Iran. So that's why, that's why I'm saying I'm not sure whether he has full control over this situation. And this is why, I when Trump came to power, he came to the White House with a very strong public mandate. And he's been promising no more wars. He said, we're going to be withdrawing forces from here and from there and so forth. And even in his first administration between 2017 and 2021, we know that he really did want to withdraw US troops from Iraq, from Syria, from Germany even, and that he was basically sabotaged at that. And that they, there was a strong lobbying pressure exerted against him to go to war against Iran, even in 2019. And at that time, he knew to say, no, I'm not interested. This is a dumb idea. I'm not doing it. So something happened this time around. What happened, that would be interesting to understand.
So we talked about control. How much control does Donald Trump have here? I've heard all sorts of stuff from, okay, this was supposed to have this Iran war was supposed to be 3 or 4 or 5 days max. Seems to be a quite a miscalculation there. But yes, this anti-war president has become like as some would say, a warmonger. Or just someone who is entering wars that we have no business being in. What do you make of the narrative? This is about nuclear weapons, national security, uranium, or even oil markets. Is President Trump, as advocates would say, he's playing 4D chess, and as critics would say, he doesn't know what he's doing, or worse, the strings are being pulled by, Zionist extremists. Is the other question with that is do you see more credence with Donald Trump pulling the strings or Netanyahu pulling the strings? Who's the head of the snake, if you will?
Excellent question, Steve. And that is the one that has been almost haunting me obsessively for the last 30 years. Because, we've over the last 30 years or so, more than 30, we've seen many, many wars. And there's always a narrative that goes along, And I participated in one in the early 1990s. I'm from Croatia. We had the wars of succession in former Yugoslavia. And the narratives don't ever make sense, which is why they're always shifting and changing. And then you ask yourself, well, what was all this about, really? And we saw the same with, after 9/11 with Afghanistan and then Iraq. And then, it's been one war after another in Sudan and Yemen and some of them by proxy, some of them directly, Ukraine. And there's always a narrative attached. And the other side is always demonized. Like we just have to go to that war because Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and he's a madman. And we have to take those away from him because the whole world is at risk. Okay, then it turns out he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Everybody was lying, but the world moves on. And then like, oh, Muammar Gaddafi, he's a madman. He's killing his own people. We have to take him out to save the Libyan people and bring democracy and freedom and prosperity to Libya. Of course, they ship out the gold. They take the oil contracts, and they leave the country as a failed state. And then the next madman that has to be dealt with is Bashar al-Assad. And he's terrible. A dictator, madman, killing his own people, crossing red lines, using chemical weapons, all of that. And he's taken out. And who takes him out as a proxy force? The Al-Qaeda, the terror. None of this makes any sense, right? And then we see, like if you want to be a little bit cynical, then you see that, well, what's the deal with all these ExxonMobils and Shells and Chevrons and KBRs and Halliburtons who just immediately move in? Like you take over a country and they move in, they take the mining contracts, the oil contracts, the gas contracts, the port management contracts. Building nuclear power plants, taking control of the infrastructure, then suddenly, oh, guess what? In Iraq, you're no longer going to be using your heirloom seeds. You're going to be using GMOs because, that's how it's done today. And then, no more locally produced pharmaceuticals. Now it's all going to be coming from Pfizer and so forth. And so that's, the multinational corporations have a very visible role here. We see them, and we associate everything that follows with, like, oh yeah, so it's the military industrial complex, and it's the big oil and the big ag and the big pharma and the big tech. They're all pushing for this war. But one group that is almost never mentioned, but who is the ultimate beneficiary of these forever wars are the bankers. And what do they gain from this? They gain collateral. Because once you take political control of a country like Iraq, Libya, Syria, Iran, Ukraine, Russia, whoever, then at that point you can make sure that these oil contracts and nuclear power plant contracts and port management and healthcare and agriculture and everything, that all these contracts are given to Western corporations. But these Western corporations, they're clients of Western banks. And when they enter these countries, they need very large loans to finance the developments there. And so they're going to turn to JP Morgan and Citigroup and Royal Bank of Scotland and BNP Paribas and so forth. And then they're going to go in there with that money. But see, these loans are created out of thin air. And the second that, let's say, JP Morgan gives a $1 billion loan to ExxonMobil, that very second, that loan becomes a $1 billion asset on JP Morgan's balance sheet. So instantly, JP Morgan is $1 billion richer than they were a moment before that. And then that loan has to be paid back, repaid with interest by the client, which means that they have to earn that money in Iraq or wherever they went. So by having political control over the country, they become able to make sure that those contracts will be serviced and that those loans will be repaid. And so
Yeah.
ExxonMobil has to go in there, do the heavy lifting and dirty work, but the banks, they just write in a balance into your account, and from that moment on, they're $1 billion richer. And then next, they're going to give a $1 billion contract to Monsanto, or however much, it could be less, it could be more. Then they're going to give a contract to Westinghouse to build the nuclear power plants. Then they're going to give contracts to, I don't know, Halliburton or KBR to build roads or so all of these companies go and they do something. And of course, they make profits and their CEOs get their bonuses and so, but they are all clients of the banking cartel, like it's a higher and that incentive is, I believe, what is driving the forever wars. Because you also have to take into account that corporations,
Wow.
there are two things that differentiates corporations from banks. Corporations would have a choice to do business on a different basis. That is, they let's say ExxonMobil could go to Iran. They could purchase crude oil from Iranian exporting companies and then put on their margin and resell it to Europe, United States, wherever, right? And they could have a great business of this. They don't need to go into Iran itself and
No.
develop Iranian resources. So that's one. So they could do business on a completely, they could simply pursue a different business model that doesn't require warfare, that doesn't require American military bases in the country and control over the political over the nation's political power. And then the second thing that differentiates banks from corporations is that a corporation doesn't care where the funding comes from. If they need $1 billion to develop Iranian energy sector, they don't care whether that $1 billion comes from a Chinese bank or from a Russian bank or from an Iranian bank or from a JP Morgan. But JP Morgan does care.
Yeah.
Because if the loan comes from JP Morgan, then that's a $1 billion asset on JP Morgan's balance sheet. If it comes from a Russian bank, that's a $1 billion asset on the Russian bank's balance sheet. So, for the banks, it's an all or nothing situation. For the corporation, we can do it this way, we can do it that way. So they're not the ultimate source of the incentives for forever wars. The banks are the ultimate source of
Yeah.
incentive for forever war. And then the way these corporations choose their business model, they practically all have somebody from a too big to fail bank on their board of directors to make sure that they pursue the right business model.
Yeah.
And so I think, Steve, that is ultimately where the pressure to go to war in Ukraine, to go to war in Iran, to go to war wherever, Libya, Syria, that's where it's coming from, ultimately.
Alex, thanks for making me more depressed this morning about how the world works a bit. Just in terms of where, what questions we should be asking. Who benefits? Who's incentivized? Where's the money going? Where's the money flowing? It makes me wonder just how wars are not really for, or how decisions are made for countries is not even for the benefit of the US people, but certain rich people in certain positions of power. So if you can talk a little bit more about that, and if you can tell me based off of that premise, what questions should we be asking? And then based off that premise, how does this war end?
Well, we should, the first question we should be always be asking is who benefits. That's obvious, And I think that in analyzing all these things, we always have to depart from the broadest possible context about what's going on. And I think that the broadest, this broad context has been pretty much given to us by many of the people who are high-level operatives in the Western world. And so one of them was George Soros, who said that this is a conflict between two systems of governance. And when I say this, he was talking about generally the whole world, because it would appear that the war in Iran is a very different thing from the war in Ukraine, which is a very different thing with this behind the tension between China and the United States is a very different thing. And then the blockade of Cuba is a diff completely different thing, and so forth. But they're actually all battlefields, different battlefields in the same conflict. And so that conflict is, as George Soros put it, between two systems of governance. Klaus Schwab said basically the same thing. Kurt Volker, who used to be US ambassador to NATO, he said the same thing. Many, many Western officials talk about the conflict of two systems of governance, right? And so usually they will characterize it as a conflict between democracies and dictatorships or autocracies, right? George
Right.
Soros likes to talk about conflict between open societies and closed societies. And of course, the open societies, the Western liberal democracies, that's the source of light. And these dictatorship and closed societies, they're the source of darkness. And so we
Right.
have to obviously kill them all and, make the world democratic, make the world safe for democracy. Right, but what it really is, of course, like they are right that this is a conflict between two systems of governance, but they mischaracterize it. And the real I think that a more accurate way to characterize it would be to say that it's a conflict between the Western imperialism, the neo-colonialist system of governance, and everybody who is brazen enough to resist, to say no, we will, and to decline to submit to the Western Empire. And where does this neo-colonialist approach come from? It comes from, again, from Western bankers, from the Western banking centers. And I believe that the headquarters of this system is the City of London, that its main satellite is Wall Street. And then it has dendrites spread to other satellites like Paris and Frankfurt and Stockholm and Rome and Tokyo, Seoul, UAE, and so forth. Now, why does the Western Empire pursue colonialism? It's exactly because they are always preying on collateral. control of collateral, because we've adopted centuries ago, probably 500 or 600 years ago, we've adopted a fraudulent monetary system. So all the money that goes into circulation in the West and everywhere in the world, in fact, only comes into circulation as debt. So, money comes into existence as debt, meaning you go to the bank, you say, I need to borrow $1 million. They give you $1 million. Now there's $1 million to spend around. The problem is that you have to repay it with interest. But the amount of interest never enters into circulation. It doesn't exist, right? You got $1 million. Maybe if it's a typical mortgage, you have to repay 2 million over the next 20, 30 years. But the other million doesn't exist. So how can you repay 2 million if you just borrowed one? Well, you have to obviously earn it off of other participants. And where do they get it? They get it by they themselves getting into debt, right? But every time somebody gets into debt, less money goes into circulation that is owed back to the bankers. And you can see that. You can pull up these aggregates, at least for the United States. If you go to Fred database, I think it's called Federal Reserve Educational Data or something like this. It's under Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. They have all these aggregates, all this data that you can pull out. And so you can go and take the monetary base, right? The monetary base shows you how much money is actually in circulation in the economy. And then you can pull up total credit market debt. And total credit market debt, they renamed this. It's called something all sectors, blah 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 blah. But if you type in to the search engine total credit market debt, it'll still find it. And then you can plot these two time series on a chart, and you will see that the monetary base grows like this, and that the total credit market debt grows like that. And there's a gap of about 20-fold between them. So I think that if you take total monetary, the monetary base, last time I looked, it was about $6 trillion. So all the money that circulated in the economy was about $6 trillion. And the total credit market debt was, so this is, public debt, private debt, corporate and bank financial debt. So all the debts that are in the economy, they come to about, let's call it 120 trillion. So that's six versus 120. It's very close to 20-fold, which means that all, the monetary base is all the money that's available for repaying all the debts is 1/20th of the amount of all the debts. It's like the textbook definition of unsustainable. So to keep growing, to keep for banks to keep growing their system, they need to issue more debt, ever more debt, ever more debt. And I don't know how prosperous you are, but let's say that maybe a bank will give you $1 million, right? And so they'll say, like, okay, we think you can pay this back. You have a house. We'll mortgage your house, right? And if you fail to pay, we'll repossess your house. But if you ask them to give you $1 billion, maybe they'll say, no, because we don't believe that you will be able to pay this back. So it means that there's a limit of how much debt you can saddle any one person, any one company, any one government with, because the collateral in the system is limited. But if you run a Ponzi scheme, it has to grow. If it doesn't grow, so sorry. If it doesn't
It's okay.
grow, it mathematically collapses. There's no, it's baked into it's baked into the equation. There's just like no way to avoid it. And so the only way to keep it growing is to bring more collateral into the system. And where do you find more collateral? Well, Saudi Arabia has oil, Iran has oil and gas and other things. The Caribbean countries, they can grow cocoa and coffee and pineapples and so forth. Mexico has oil and gas and corn and so you just kind of you use your wealth
Yeah.
to build up a military industrial complex, to take control of the media, to tell people how evil the president of Mexico is, and of Libya and of Syria. And then you mobilize the whole society kind of to go fighting demons around the world. You take political control of those countries. And then once you have political controls of your countries, then you control their collateral and you can grow your Ponzi scheme. But you
Yeah.
can't stop it. And then, like once you're done with the madman Saddam Hussein, then you have to take down the madman Gaddafi, and then you have to take down the Hugo Chavez because he's a communist, and then you have to take down Bashar al-Assad, then you have to take down the Iranians, then you have to take down the Chinese and the Ukrainians and the Russians and so forth. This particular system of governance cannot stop metastasizing. It's like a cancer. It has to keep growing. So there's never a shortage of demons to fight and madmen in the world, and there's no other way to fight them than by military means or by sabotage, terrorism, color revolutions, and so forth. There's no question about, well, we have our differences, but we don't have to go to war. We have to take them down. And this is the reality that we've been living with forever. When it wasn't the Middle Eastern madmen, we had communists in Vietnam, in Korea, in Chile. Salvador Allende was a communist. If we didn't take him down, there would be a domino effect in South America, and all the South American countries would become communist. So obviously Salvador Allende had to be toppled, and he was. Anyway, going back to your question, we have the narratives today. Oh, it's about the nuclear program. Oh, it's about the ballistic missiles. Oh, it's about women's rights and veils and all of these things that are calculated to kind of gain public support for the war. But that these people couldn't care less about the nuclear program or the ballistic missile, and let alone women's rights. They don't care a hoot about
Yeah.
that. What they care about is collateral. And Iran is the fifth richest nation in the world in terms of natural resources, estimated at about $30 trillion. And they also have 92 million plus population. And you need population because those resources are not just going to extract themselves and load themselves on ships. You need
Right.
slave labor for that. So that's why we go to war.
Well, Alex, we're at war with Iran, but one of the things that maybe people aren't talking about for the U.S. is how maybe U.S. seems to be more at war with itself than anything. I'd love to get your thoughts on that. In particular, I caught wind that the Fox News announced that the CIA raided Tulsi Gabbard's office, seizing JFK assassination and MK Ultra files that were ordered for declassification. But then it looked like the story got quickly challenged, downplayed, or whatnot. And I'd love to know what you actually heard, and how do you make sense of everything that's happened, how it's unfolded, and the sequence of how it was reported.
I heard what you just laid out, Steve, and I saw that later it was qualified that, like, oh no, nothing to see here, disperse. But it's an interesting story, because Tulsi Gabbard is normally the superior to Radcliffe, who is the CIA director. Tulsi Gabbard is director of national intelligence, meaning she's above all the other intelligence agencies, and I believe that there's 18 of them today, and CIA is one of them. So the fact that we had certain Congress people react to this tells me that there's something real happened. It's being deflected, it's being played down, but something real happened, and I think it's very highly controversial. Which again suggests that there are forces behind the scenes that have very powerful influence, and that that can override the DNI, that can override the president even, and gain control of the whole administration. And another example is the election of Thomas Massie. So Thomas Massie is running for re-election to Congress, and by all accounts, he's very popular with his constituents. They like him, they want to re-elect him, but he's being targeted by essentially three Zionist billionaires. Not Sheldon Adelson, his widow. I always forget her first name. Well, Miss Adelson, let's say. Paul Singer and another person I forget. So they've made it their raison d'être in life to make sure that Thomas Massie is not re-elected to Congress. And the reason why Thomas Massie was insisting on release of the Epstein files, and he's also consistently votes against foreign aids, including to Israel, and then he doesn't have an AIPAC handler. So that kind of reveals where the pressure is coming from, and it seems that it's coming from the Zionist angle. And then apparently, what's being discussed in the conspiracy grapevines is that JFK files, the parts that have never been released, also point to Israel as the culprit for JFK's assassination. So again, the same interests don't want us to know about these things. And then obviously at this stage, the same interests appear to have had decisive influence on Trump to launch the war that he knew not to launch up until 28 February. Somehow they prevailed. I don't know how, but somehow they did. And oh well, Trump owns it now. There's no question about that. But by all accounts, he wasn't interested in doing that. He was extremely critical. He knew that the idea was really dumb, that the risks were enormous. He had advisors around him who were telling him the same thing, and in the end, he decided against all that. He removed the dissenters. He kept around the, now he's best friends with people who hated him for not sufficiently supporting Israel. But so that's very bizarre. But I think what it tells us is that these certain interests are so powerful and so determined that they can override the president. And then we also know, we have JFK files because somebody actually assassinated JFK. So we also
Right.
know that if the president defies them, they have no problem killing the president. And so they assassinated JFK, they assassinated RFK, and nobody was held accountable for that. Those investigations were never reached their final conclusion, right? They gave us a lone gunman, somebody to say, okay, disperse. Same could be said about Charlie Kirk. Very similar story, very similar suspect. And so what does that mean? That they get away with these assassinations, which means that they end up more powerful than they were before that, which means that over all these decades, they've been gaining more and more and more and more power. And so if they have all this power, can they override the president? And if the president says, no, I don't want to attack Iran, then he ends up attacking it anyway. And then, Tulsi Gabbard's office gets raided. How did that happen? By her underlings. And then Charlie Kirk gets assassinated, lone gunman. Thomas Massie is being attacked. And so,
I love how you said that. Just so everyone knows, I'm not suicidal. I'm in good health. And so if I'm dead, just know that it wasn't my idea. That is very scary when you hear stuff like that. Like going back to the CIA and the JFK files, I've read and heard, Israel being implicated in some of those files along with the CIA. Love to know what the purpose of what is the CIA, exactly. How powerful is it? Who keeps it in check? Is there any truth to the idea this is like, a fourth branch with limited oversight, maybe a tool by these lobbyists. What do you make of that?
The CIA was created from the OAS, Office of, I forget, it was the World War II Foreign Intelligence Administration, and then it became the CIA, and it became CIA in 1947, and apparently it was modeled on MI6, and some of the same people that were high-level OAS operatives were also very high-level MI6 operatives. And it seems to me that this is one of the core elements in the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. And so I think that the CIA probably is the foreign element inside of the US administration that actually plays a very, very strong role in pulling the United States into all these imperialist misadventures, that they're deeply involved in clandestine operations, in not just finding out information about foreign things, but doing things like running organized crime networks, drug smuggling, people smuggling, and that they work very closely together with MI6, with the Mossad, with the German intelligence, Italian intelligence, and so forth. And so I think it's basically a criminal element at heart of the US administration. And I'm not even saying anything very controversial. They've been caught many times. We had in the 1980s, we had the Iran-Contras affair, which was investigated rather thoroughly, and we learned that CIA was doing very illegal things, smuggling drugs, smuggling weapons, funding terrorist organizations, and so forth. They're still at it, we know that Pablo Escobar was very probably a CIA asset, according to his own son. We know that CIA is all over the Mexican drug cartels. And it's on and on and on. It's a very dangerous organization, and I think that it's so dangerous that even presidents are afraid of it.
Well, Alex, we've talked about a lot. Is there anything else that you see that we haven't addressed that you're watching closely right now, in terms of how global politics feeds into the larger economic picture, or anything that people aren't talking about that you think should be is alarming to you?
Yes, in fact, I think that The fact that we are seeing more and more, we're seeing a certain escalation in the conflict. So it's not only that the United States is at war against Iran, that is deeply involved in Lebanon, Syria, Ukraine, that the relations with China are kind of a potential war that's always there that could go up, but that we see the conflict at home. We just saw this CIA attack on Tulsi Gabbard, their superior, right? Whatever the truth about that, something very
Supposedly.
controversial happened. We see an attack against Thomas Massie, political attack, not physical, but still. We see more and more talk about escalating controls, digital IDs, CBDCs, censorship. We now see, get again another pandemic, apparently, that they're planning to ambush us with. So all of these things are escalating, and I believe that the reason why they're escalating is because the people who are actually in power are, I think that they're losing across the board and that they're panicked. So I think that we're living like the kitchen sink moment in this conflict between two systems of governance. Because they, over the last few years, they had a handful of really, really important projects that it needed to accomplish to continue to expand their spheres of control. One of them was the pandemic 6 years ago. And the point of that pandemic is that it was supposed to usher the new normal. We're supposed to be moving around with vaccine certificates at all times, and we were supposed to be getting our boosters indefinitely. And they were pretty much promising us that we were never going back to the old normal. And then, that kind of fell apart. Then their next very, very important project was Project Ukraine. And Ukraine was supposed to be used as a bludgeon to destroy Russia. It didn't work. Ukraine is getting defeated, and Russia is still standing. And then the third really big project was the Project Iran. That one failed too. And then there was a whole lot of like other projects, maybe less important, but really important. Still, one of them was that, they were supposed to do away with the Second Amendment in the United States. They were, like they disarmed the Australian people, they disarmed the British people. They were supposed to disarm the American people as well, but that didn't work. And so a lot of these things just didn't work out. And they're getting beat by the Russians. They're getting beat by the Iranians. China is taking the lead in the world in terms of developing new technologies and becoming, at least in purchasing power parity terms, the largest economy in the world. And so they're losing ground. And what's going to happen is that people in places like Canada, United States, Western Europe, UK are now on the verge of revolting. So not only are they fighting China, Russia, Iran, and any other state that opposes them, they also have to pacify populations at home to make sure that they don't get overthrown, that they don't have a revolution or a civil war on their hands. So that's why, they're now scrambling to introduce digital IDs and CBDCs and, to control our access to social networks and to media and internet and so forth. And I think that this is the reason why they pulled out this hantavirus pandemic, because it's again a way to lock us down to strictly control how we can move, how we cannot move, how we can communicate, and so forth. So I think it's all part of this agenda, except that I believe that it's going to fail again because, 6 years ago, they really ambushed us. The most people were not prepared to believe that their authorities were lying to them, and that, like the public health authorities and the government and the media and everybody was collaborating, cooperating on a project that was basically a hoax. Well, now if you look at social media, nobody's buying this hantavirus scare. Pretty much 100, very close to 100 and 100% of all the comments on X are ridiculing the World Health Organization, which is very, 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 very different from the way people reacted in 2020.
Yeah. Well, Alex, lots to keep an eye on. You mentioned London being the headquarters. I'd love to get your input on that next time. I'd love to talk to you more about the virus if it's we'll see where we're at. But Alex, it's been a
Well,
pleasure to have
apparently it
you.
has a 6 week, it has a 6 week incubation period, so we'll probably know more by I think around mid-June we'll know where we're
Well,
at.
Alex, before we let you go, if you can just tell our people where to follow your work, how people can best reach out to you and find you.
Absolutely, thank you. It's my handle on X is at Naked Hedgie. Then I have two publication on Substack. One of them is a daily trend following market report covering 19 global markets. It's called iSystem Trend Compass. And then I also have a personal publication called Alex Craner's Substack. And as of this year, I reactivated my YouTube channel, which is Alex Craner, just simply Alex Craner, because there's another one called Alex Craner Official, which is an AI fraud. That's not me, so don't go there.
So anytime someone has to put official, it's not official.
Yeah, I should probably say a real Alex Craner or something like that.
Alex, thank you so much for being here. For all our listeners, I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from people more interesting, intelligent people like Alex Craner. So Alex, thank you. Everybody stay smart, curious, disciplined. And until next time, be good.
Thank you very much.